Today is Tuesday, June 30th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning, we have Fred Niedner. Today's session number is 98-2, and it's titled, Lord, Remember Us in Your Kingdom and Open Our Arms. Let's listen in.
Take, please. We'll start with the same hymn we sang last evening at Vespers. It's number 765 in With One Voice. And you are the guest in every one of our encounters all of our days. Be with us, guide us, teach us that we may open our arms to you, to one another, and in one another to ourselves. In Jesus' name, amen. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana. This is a Bible study on another theme from Practicing Our Faith, the theme book for this summer. And today we're thinking about and talking about hospitality, which was the theme of last evening's Vespers and Christine's wonderful homily. It was the theme yesterday as well of Walt Wongren's session. And probably the theme of some other things going on, including this movie last evening, Weapons of the Spirit. So by the end of the day, if we are not hospitality-ized, maybe it can't happen. For the hilarity quotient of the day, I brought along, hospitality humor is not easy to find. But I did have something which is sort of vaguely connected. Many of you are familiar with HMOs, but maybe not many of you familiar with MFOs, which are managed friendship organizations. If you can't find or don't want to find your own friends, you can now join an MFO and they'll find them for you. So someone sent me this, and I'll just share a few pieces of it with you. The Managed Friendship Plan combines all the advantages of a traditional friendship network with important cost-saving features. A bunch of frequently asked questions then. How does it work? Under the plan, you choose your friends from a network of pre-screened accredited accredited friendship providers, FPs. All your friendship needs are met by members of your managed friendship staff. Question, what's wrong with my current friend? If you're like most people, you're receiving friendship services from a network of providers haphazardly patched together from your old neighborhoods, jobs, and schools. The result is often costly duplication, inefficiency, and even conflict. Many of your current friends may not meet national standards. Responding to your needs with inappropriate, outmoded, or even experimental acts of friendship. Under managed friendship, your friendship needs are coordinated by our designated best friend, who will ensure the quality and goodness of fit of all your friendly relationships. Question, how do I know the plan's panel of friends is not made up of a bunch of losers who can't make friends on their own? Many of today's most dedicated and highly trained friendship providers are as concerned as we are about delivering quality friendship in a cost-effective manner. They have joined our network because they want to focus on acting like a friend rather than doing the paperwork and paying the high bad friendship premiums that have caused the cost of traditional friendship to skyrocket. Our friendship providers have met our rigorous standards of companionship and loyalty. And then a bunch of other questions like, what if I need a special friend, say, for poker or fishing? What if I want to see friends outside the managed friendship network? That's okay, but only in an emergency. Then the question comes up, what is a friendship emergency? And then what friendly activities are covered under the plan and which are not? And those that are covered include agreeing with you, appearing sympathetic, chewing the fat, dropping by, feeling your pain, gossiping, hanging out, holding your hand up to 5 minutes per activity, kidding around, listening to you whine, patting your back, sharing a meal, shooting the breeze, slinging the bull, and teasing. Those that are not covered include bending over backwards, giving a hoot, going the extra mile, real empathy, or truly caring. So, that's, I guess, managed hospitality, which I think, by the way, our culture is all too good at. Managed hospitality, which is one of the reasons why genuine hospitality may be more in short supply among us than in cultures where there is no managed hospitality. We say, let the pros do it. Hospitality isn't quite as exotic a thing in some ways as Sabbath, but we'll look at some typical examples of the way hospitality was practiced in the biblical period, very ancient examples, some of the ways that Torah prescribes hospitality, or commands it, I mean, a couple of New Testament texts and stories, and begin with a story which kind of gives us a glimpse, as ugly as this story is, it gives us a glimpse of how hospitality was supposed to work in ancient times. Would you turn, please, to Judges chapter 19. Judges 19 is the story of a Benjaminite man who had a falling out with a wife who was in the category of concubine, and so he goes, the woman leaves him and returns to her home. He goes and woos her and convinces her to return back to his home, and the story that ensues then is the story of their return to the region of Benjamin, and we'll pick it up at verse 10. The father-in-law tries to get the couple to spend one more night in his home, but they refuse. The man would not spend the night, and he got up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddle donkeys, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come, let's turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." But his master said, "We will not turn aside into a city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will continue on to Gibeah." Jerusalem wasn't yet an Israelite city. It wasn't until the time of David, who conquered it for his capital. And so here's one little clue about hospitality. They did not want to risk seeking hospitality in the normal way in a city that was not an Israelite city. They sensed a danger there that might not be present in a more friendly or a place of their own people. Then he said to his servants, "Come, let's try to reach one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or Ramah." So they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. He went in and sat down in the open square of the city, but no one took them in to spend the night. And that's what you're supposed to do. You go to a city and go into the square, and someone's supposed to take you in. You don't go knocking on doors and say, "Can I stay there?" That's a violation of the protocols. But you just go into an obvious place and everyone will know you're a stranger and someone is supposed to take you in. That's how it is supposed to work. And at first, no one does. But sure enough, at evening, that means at sunset, there was an old man coming from his work in the field from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was residing in Gibeah. The old man looked up and saw the wayfarer in the open square of the city and said, "Where are you going? Where are you from?" The man answers, "We're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim. I went to Bethlehem in Judah and I'm going home. Nobody has offered to take me in. We have our own straw and fodder for our donkeys. We have bread and wine for me and the woman and the young man with us. We don't need anything more." The old man says the traditional greeting, "Peace be with you. I'll take care of things. Don't spend the night in the square." So he brought him into his house, fed the donkeys, washed their feet, and ate and drank. That's typical hospitality. That's the way it's supposed to work. You see a stranger in the public place, you take them in and see to their needs. What transpires, of course, is a dreadful story, which also teaches something about hospitality. This band of hooligans shows up in the night wanting some way or another to assault the man, the guest, and to protect the man, they offer his wife to the crowds, and the crowds, rascals, rape and abuse her and leave her dead at the doorstep in the night. But the rules of hospitality were such that at any cost, the host would protect the male guests. You would protect the female guests if you could, but not, I mean, they weren't as important to protect as the males. And in fact, because they were property, they could be expended, actually, as part of what you might have to do in order to protect male guests. So that's a terrible story, and it's a story that starts a war, and it's ultimately told as a story that is one of the things that triggers the need for something else that's got its own difficulties, namely the monarchy. But there's a glimpse of hospitality and how it's supposed to work. There's a similar story back in Genesis 19, And the reason we'll go there is because it's next door to a more ideal story, Genesis 18. But please look at Genesis 19. This is the story of Lot entertaining the same individuals that Abraham has earlier entertained. Lot is sitting in the gateway of Sodom when he sees two, what the reader knows are angels, but simply two fellows, two messengers. And Lot rises to greet them, bows his face to the ground, invites them into his home. He invites them, come and spend the night, where we will wash your feet and you can rise early and go on your way. They say, no, we'll spend the night in the square. But he urged them strongly, so they turned aside and entered his house and made them a feast of baked unleavened bread. And then, of course, we have this scenario where, once again, a bunch of rowdies from the town show up, and they almost once again, well, this is obviously much earlier than the other story, but we have another incident where they're willing to pay the price of protecting the men by expending the women. But there you have the another story of the form of how hospitality is supposed to work. The guest is willing to spend the night in the public square, but the townspeople won't let it happen. They invite the stranger in, and they wash their feet, and they make him a feast. And that's the way it's supposed to work. So the form is, you don't invite yourself in. You are willing to be, you admit you are the stranger. You're willing to be in the public place, but no one's supposed to let you stay there. So somebody is supposed to invite you in. This is how it's supposed to work. And you protect the guest in whatever way you can. Genesis 18 is another of these stories, though without the danger of a night assault, as we see in the others. The interesting thing about this story, now Abraham doesn't know, or at least we're not told clearly that he knows exactly who he's hosting, but three strangers show up. And we don't have a town square or anything like that, but Abraham runs from his tent out a ways to meet this group. They haven't actually come to him and asked for hospitality. He goes out and offers it. And this story is so amusing because in his invitation to them, he offers them a little bread, a morsel of bread, and I'll wash your feet. And so it's the typical and expected hospitality. But then Abraham sort of goes loony with this. And if you read this in the original Hebrew, you can see that instead of giving them a little bread, he's making just monstrous portions of food, and killing all kinds of animals. And I mean, 5 bushels of wheat he has ground into flour to make bread, and there's only 6 people eating. This is just extravagance that Abraham provides, and hurrying around, scurrying, being host. He was doing the best he could. And then, of course, we have the Annunciation and so forth that's connected with this story. But those are just 3 glimpses of how hospitality was supposed to work. One more story I'd like us to look at, which is a kind of anti-hospitality, but gives us a clue as to something we want to see in the legislation that we'll look at in a moment. Flip to Genesis 42 for a moment, please. This is the story of Joseph receiving his brothers who have sold him into slavery and now themselves have become sojourners, as it were. They've traveled to Egypt in order to get bread or food and take it back home. And I didn't mark the verse where he recognizes them. Verse 7. The brothers come and bow down before him. And we see in 42:7, when Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he treated them like strangers and spoke harshly to them. Now, this is a little different situation because Joseph is acting as an official and many people are coming to him in order to make a purchase. But this is told sort of as a hospitality story here. And later on in the story, he will, of course, do the hospitable thing and he'll make them a banquet and so forth. But in this case, we're told in a very pointed way that though Joseph recognized them as brothers, he treated them as strangers. And this is in that culture a huge violation in a certain way, because as we'll see in a moment, the point of hospitality is to treat someone as something other than just a stranger. You are supposed to recognize in them the kinship of humanity you share with them. So here Joseph is actually, there's a very strong verb of recognition here, and he refuses to act on it. He knows exactly that he's dealing with his own flesh and blood, and he denies his flesh and blood connection to them. So this is an anti-hospitality episode here. The care of strangers and aliens as individuals isn't legislated clearly in Torah, but there are a couple of texts, this book points some of them out, which talk about hospitality in a general sense, how you are to treat those who live amongst you who are strangers. So for example, would you turn please to Leviticus 19 for a moment, and we'll look at two pieces of this legislation, because it gives the rationale for why you need to be hospitable to strangers. Leviticus 19:33. When an alien resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress the alien. The alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. This is apparently a kind of a class as opposed to an individual thing. There is an alien population among you, and you must treat them as you treat yourself. Treat them as though they were your own kind of folk. The word for aliens here is the word that's often translated in older translations, sojourners. In Hebrew it's ger, the category I think I referred to yesterday as the guest workers, the migrant worker group that virtually every culture had back then. and you must treat those people in the same way you treat your own people. And in fact, you used to be there, remember? Don't forget, just like with the Sabbath commandment, never forget that you were slaves. Don't forget either that you were strangers. And remember what it's about, being strangers. And so treat those kind of folks in your own midst as though they were your own people. And again, and also notice the verb here. You're to love them. And unlike Greek, where you get to choose between different kinds of love, agape, philia, eros, you know, sacrificial love, friendship love, passionate love. There's only one verb for love in Hebrew. So you love those people, period. Deuteronomy 10 is another such text. You shall also love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. In a list of other things you're supposed to be doing. This is a characteristic of how you are as God's people. This is to be for you like breathing air and drinking water. You will love strangers. So that's the background in the Hebrew Bible. There is no word for hospitality. No concept that you can study and do word derivations on. It's simply illustrated for us with some stories of hospitality and a command that you will love a stranger.
Mr. Niedner?
Yeah.
I'm up here. When you're talking about this, it struck me very similar to my experiences in the Peace Corps in West Africa. When we would go in hill country and travel, we could be assured that any village we went into, that they would be required to put us up. We just had to present ourselves to the village chieftain, and he would put us up in his house or someone else's house and then feed us. Of course, it was understood that if we did that, we should also provide some gifts as a means of thank you. But that was standard throughout much of traditional West Africa, and that's a very old custom. I didn't know if it was West African in origin or if it was Arabic, but that's a standard rule.
Yeah.
Something which would be impossible today in America.
Yeah.
Someone walking into a town and sitting there at the mayor's house and saying,
"Hello. I'm here." Yeah. Now, someone in the 745 group this morning said something similar, that they had traveled extensively in third world countries and been received quite a bit like this all over the place. And obviously, this just wouldn't happen. And someone sat in the town square of Valparaiso, Indiana, where I live. You'd sit there a long time. The police might come and say, "Sorry, you can't sit here anymore." I actually spent some time sitting at the bus station down in Wenatchee, and nobody came and took me. Obviously many reasons for this. I wouldn't be surprised that one of them is that we do have these managed care providers. You know, we have absconded from all such responsibility because there are people who do that. Motels, that's their job. We don't mess with. None of the rest of us have to do hospitality.
That's Traveler's aid.
Pardon?
Traveler's aid.
Yeah.
Oscar Willie comes down.
Yeah. The New Testament does have words for, they have the category of strangers and so forth, but also a word for hospitality. And those of you who were at Walt's session yesterday got some of the Greek and the Latin background for these words. The New Testament's word for a stranger, I have it in English characters up here, xenos, which you may recognize from such English words as xenophobia, the fear of strangers. But the fascinating thing about that term is that in Greek, that word not only means stranger, it also means both guest and host. And so in the category itself, there is the recognition that at the beginning of the relationship anyway, both the guest and the host are strangers to each other. But as we'll see, ultimately the point is that you can't distinguish which is guest and which is host. And the category of hospitality is to extend love, particularly of the philia variety, the friendship sort of love, to a xenos, to a stranger. So philoxenia is love of stranger, or could even be translated love of hosting. That's the category of hospitality. Our English word, as Walt taught those of us who in this room here yesterday, derives from a Latin hospis, which is similarly ambiguous. Means host, means guest. Hospitality is to participate in being those simultaneously. There is a handful of texts that bid us to be hospitable. And some very obvious ones. We can look at them very briefly. Matthew 25, for example, holds up for us not with the word hospitality, but surely with the phenomenon. Matthew 25 is 31 and following has the parable of the Last Judgment. And verse 35 contains this stranger word. I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was a stranger, and you gave me hospitality. And so there you have hospitality listed among those things that distinguishes, as it were, the sheep from the goats. Similar sort of or other injunctions include Romans 12, verse 13. Romans 12 describes the living sacrifice that those who are in Christ make of themselves. And in verse 13, we read, among other things that are part of this life, along with rejoicing and hope, being patient in suffering and persevering in prayer, we see contribute to the needs of the saints and extend hospitality to strangers. And finally, Hebrews 13. First couple verses, let mutual love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it, like Abraham. For example, I'm sure that's one of the pieces in the background of that text. So there you have hospitality listed numerous times among those things that are the clear characteristics of those who are in Christ. This is part of who you are. This is a part of your life as a member of this body. Hospitality is one of your behaviors and characteristics. Excuse me. Just to connect this a little bit to other things I've been doing, hilarity is one of the things that is found, the few places when it is in the New Testament, the phenomenon of hilarity. That's a Greek word, by the way, hilaros, usually translated in the New Testament with a word like cheerfulness. But the few places it's used in the New Testament, it's used as an attitude or a behavior that accompanies things like hospitality and generosity. So it's not like you welcome some stranger with gritted teeth, you know, because you got to do this. It's going to be fun, okay? So we do this with hilarity, not in some other manner. I think that among all the stories in the New Testament that demonstrate hospitality, the one that's most profound is one we already visited, if you've been in the village a while, with Christine Carlson last week, in Luke 24, the story of the Emmaus journey. I think we see some very remarkable hospitality teaching. The pair of Emmaus disciples is going back home in their disappointment and joined by this third party who appears ignorant of all these things. And notice in the story, verse 18, what Cleopas designates the third party. Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? Now, this is a little different. This word here is not xenos. This is a little different word. This is a person designated par oikia, which means it's not exactly homeless. Para is the oikos, it means house, household. But para means next to or outside of, like paranormal experiences outside the normal. This is a paroikia person. Got no place. kind of a wayfarer. So are you the only stranger in these parts who doesn't understand all this? And so we continue on with this conversation during which the disciples begin to get heartburn even before dinner. And they finally arrive at their home, and then notice we have the standard formulas of hospitality here. He appears to be going on further. He would not, according to those customs, invite himself in. But the people with the home are supposed to do that, and they do. So please come stay with us. And they had to urge him strongly, even. So he went in to stay with them. And then notice what happens. The guest blesses the bread. That's not how it's supposed to work, right? We've already lost the distinction between host and guest. And in in the scene then, they recognize the risen Christ, who in this story and others in the New Testament can be with you and you don't even realize it. This is a feature of the risen Christ. You can be in the presence, in the company of the risen Christ and not see him, not know it. And one of their great questions is, where is this risen Christ and how can you see him? A big question for Christian communities. You say this Jesus of yours is risen from the dead. Well, where is he? What's he doing? How can I see him? A couple of the answers in Luke 24 are, in the study of the scriptures, has opened up with this new way of understanding them, the kind of understanding that gives you heartburn. He is also known to you in the breaking of the bread, but he's also known to you in hospitality, in the invitation of strangers.
This is off your main point, but I'm interested in your remark that they have to persuade him strongly to accept the hospitality. Within this culture, is there some etiquette about that? You live there, so your task is to invite me, but on my part, guidelines, what if I refuse your hospitality? Is that really something that I may do, or is it proper for me to accept the hospitality?
I don't know whether there were consequences. Does anybody know that? Whether there were consequences to the refusal of hospitality? I mean, one obvious thing would be you're likely to get mugged in the town square, especially if these hooligans are out, you know, if you're not inside some walls and that crowd comes around at night, you're vulnerable. But was there a standard consequence for refusing hospitality? I'm not aware if there was.
It does seem a bit ritualized.
Oh, yes.
You have your part, I have mine.
It's definitely ritualized, yeah. Right. And there was a gentleman in the earlier session who had studied this some and said that it was a very serious violation to, as it were, invade someone else's space before you were invited. Because then you were obviously a threat. So it's very clear that you wait for the invitation.
Jesus really broke that down with Zacchaeus.
Yeah.
Stay at your house.
Yeah, he does sort of invite himself to Zacchaeus' house. Yeah. I'm coming to your house. Ready or not, here I come. Yeah.
Was he really on a journey then? Jesus.
Well, that's in Luke's gospel, and in Luke's gospel, he's only on a journey. I mean, is that before 951 when he's actually got his face set for Jerusalem, as we heard Martin preach about?
It's
after.
Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pastor Niener?
Yeah.
Is it stretching the text to apply it to the way our country treats aliens?
Well, Deuteronomy and Leviticus are, those are aimed at the people as a people, not strictly to individuals saying, you know, as individuals you ought to be hospitable. So if we choose, we could read this communally, yeah. But then we'd have to say, you can do this communally on several levels. You can do this as Holden, you can do it as congregation, you can do it as some other community that you live in. It'd be a little trickier to do this as a nation, unless you decided that we were as a nation under this covenant, and then we're into a bunch of other issues. But, you know, as a people who claim, sort of generally speaking, to be God-fearing people, it would behoove us to at least think about this, yes. Yeah.
I don't think there's an interesting parallel in that example between what's going on in the Old Testament, where, as a matter of course, in a culture where the natural world is dangerous and the social world could be dangerous, there's a utilitarian purpose to hospitality. As you said, if you sit in the square, you may be killed. If no one gives you water, you may die.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But even as you said about Sabbath, the Hebrews are given an additional reason for doing this. You should be hospitable because you were sojourners.
Yeah.
And I led you out.
Yeah.
And I gave you a place. So God is saying, even though it's a good idea generally, here's another reason to do it. And in our country, we can say the same thing about being aliens.
Yeah.
That if you go far enough back, we're all aliens. We're all here at someone else's. Everyone comes here looking for something better.
Mm-hmm.
Few people can argue, well, I came for religious freedom, but even that is, I came looking for something better. So even if you can't take that covenant, I think you can make an analogy and push it.
Thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
The thing that is very important to remember there is that the way the Bible understands it, the place you have is a gift. The place is not your place. And gifts are for sharing. And that's the thing that's so easy to forget. You know, we are so... my own personal turf and boundary issues are such that I actually think of my place as my place. You know, as opposed to remembering that this is a gift. And there's a really critical distinction that makes enormous differences.
That being parallel to the parable about having the talents and burying them. And that the people who say, well, I'm going to protect what I have, I'm going to put it in the ground and leave it there, so that when the master comes back, I can at least give him back what he gave to me, as opposed to giving it away. But you don't really get anything. We're all stewards.
Yeah.
We don't really have anything. It's a misconception. And that the idea of hospitality is, you are already given too, so just keep passing it along.
Yeah, stewardship of place, I guess.
Stewardship of place.
When you give it away, it gets richer.
Well, it's a little bit like Holden.
Yeah.
We're all here as stewards or as guests, and even when you're a guest, you offer hospitality to the next people coming in. Change your room. Make it better for the people coming after you.
Well, would you do it if you didn't have someone telling you in the morning that was a good thing to do?
Well, I think there's a jump that needs to be made. When do you take that on? When do you grow up and stop being told, clean your room? When do you do it because it's something that needs to be done and internalize it?
The power of that moving weapon of the Spirit for me last evening was the individual choices that were made. I got a sense that entire community did not organize for that action. Individuals took faith steps, took people in. The end result was the whole community took people in. If we apply that to situations in our society, we each are empowered to make those choices as we respond to grace.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to wait for an organized effort to be hospitable.
Yeah.
We do that out of individual conviction.
It was the key to remembering their history, what their education, what happened to them.
It was a faith decision on each, an individual faith decision. They didn't have a community meeting to decide that they were going to be hospitable to the Jews. Each one of them, out of their own conviction, made those choices and painted the bigger picture.
Don't you think hospitality, though, a good, other than just meeting the physical needs, or back to blurring the line of who is host and who is guest, is the story of Mary and Martha welcoming Jesus in their home. Who ended up being the host and who was the guest, and what was the most important part of hospitality in that story? think that gets at more than just providing for the physical needs of your guests.
It can extend to something as simple as with our own congregations, just to pass on peace to each other. And at least in our community, there's been major uproar at various times when passing the peace has become a big deal. The part of the congregation doesn't want to do that, and the other part does. And just extending hospitality to each other on a Sunday morning. And being concerned.
Can you say a little bit about the similarities and differences between a stranger and neighbor in the New Testament? Who is my neighbor? In the story of the Good Samaritan, is that a parable of hospitality? How is Zenos related to neighbor and the Great Commandment?
Well, it's a different category, it's a different Greek word, and actually the neighbor category derives from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew. And there's this idiom in Hebrew that uses a word countless laws and rules are set up so that you are always treating the neighbor this way or the neighbor that way, and this word for neighbor pretty much means somebody else. It's almost anybody who's around. And so that's a much more generic sort of term for another person than the stranger word. The whole business of a ger in Hebrew or a xenos in Greek is meant to distinguish somebody who simply doesn't fit in with the people we're normally around. So the Good Samaritan story really is a story that probes this anybody-ness of how you treat someone in need as opposed to someone who's literally a stranger, but by coincidence it does happen to be also a stranger, even though that isn't particularly the issue in that story. That's a good hospitality story though. I mean, because in effect that it extends hospitality clear out into the ditches. Anything else anybody want to say or ask?
Well, I'm curious as to how the Old Testament scholars dealt with the issue of the treatment of women in those stories. That just really gets in my way. I hear that, and it's hard for me to get the real, the message that I guess I'm supposed to be getting.
Yeah.
Hey, who wrote those rules?
Some man. Those are guy rules. Yeah.
Which is a patriarchal thing.
I mean, I know it was societal then, but I'm wondering how it's been dealt with, over the years by the scholars.
Well, there's all kinds of stuff written about the inhuman qualities of that behavior and that and a set of customs and mores and laws that would allow for that or even deem that appropriate as a method of protecting the men. And obviously most of us would surely find this utterly abhorrent. There are a whole lot of issues here. What do you do with stories like this? I mean, do you keep on reading them? Do we slice these out of our Bible? Do you let children read the Bible with this stuff in it? There's all kind of stuff like that. I only brought them up as examples of how hospitality was practiced, and it's simply an unhappy fact of life in ancient history that...
Yeah, not so ancient. But
on a slightly different tack, the reason to extend hospitality is in some extent to protect them from others who are in the hospital.
Yeah.
Who are the hooligans, as you term them. And what, how far do we extend this hospitality? If, as in the Old Testament, somebody comes and they are hooligans, do we still treat them as...
Xenos?
Xenos?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about, obviously, which weapons of the spirit is clearly about, is the vulnerability that's related to hospitality. I mean, nobody who invites someone else in, Abraham doesn't know those three guys coming up the road aren't hooligans. That's a very real risk anytime you invite somebody in. I don't pick up hitchhikers anymore. I used to.
Does Sarah have anything to say as to who gets in? I would think, given what you told us, Sarah is more in jeopardy than Abraham, speaking figuratively. And shouldn't she be consulted?
Not in that culture. No. Hospitality involves enormous levels of vulnerability. Because in two ways, as these stories illustrate, you could accidentally or unwittingly invite a hooligan in, but as this story also demonstrates, when you invite anybody in, you risk having other hooligans around to destroy you because of your guests.
Well, that was in the New Testament, or in the Old Testament stories too.
Yeah. And if you are too friendly with strangers in some of our cities, your neighbors are going to come down on you.
Even today, I think in our homily last night that was shared with us, when there are catastrophes here in our country, tornadoes, floods, there are the great many that come in to help with good intentions. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, more police are brought in to stop the
looting.
The looting and the bad things.
Yeah.
I'm from Silver Valley, and that did not happen. Mm-hmm. There was no looting in the town that was north of us, the town that lost their home for several weeks of 70,000. There was no looting in the subsequent weeks. Once people started to move back in several months later, then there was some vandalizing, but not during those first few months. And there were no, we had some National Guard that came in and they were helping sandbag, but there was no destruction of property. And we had thousands from all over the upper Midwest, even from the coasts of the community. It was an incredible process. And our homes were open. The doors were never shut. You never knew who was in the room. It was one of the more profound things that I've ever seen in my life. So, yes, we took many risks. We had to. We were forced to become hospitable because we had need. Now we're back to sort of normal, where our doors are locked again. And now, as Christine was beginning to address last night, we're not dealing with this on a theological level yet. Christine wasn't that. She said, I haven't touched on all of it yet, and we'll get there. But those of us from the Valley were sitting here last night, and I'm still in this dealing with it. It's a process of opening up again. Passing the peace is not as hard now in my congregation. And I belong to one of the larger congregations in Portland, where I'm at. As it was prior to that, people are starting to take that personal risk and open themselves up, and the doors are opening further as well. There is major risk, but I think we're mandated that we do that. And yes, we may lose a life. Many here have been overseas. You may lose your life as you go someplace to offer what hospitality you can. we have an excellent life. There's something of a great promise. And so, yeah, we may be risking something on earth, but this is all known as to us. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
The image of your part of the country held in the minds of folks who live in urban communities is that you don't have any strangers where you are.
Well, there's a story in the paper before I left of an Hispanic family who has done very well. You know, they're upper middle class, graduate degrees, so on. And they're leaving our community because there's been a group of teenage boys who have harassed them to the degree, calling them white wannabes and such. So yeah, the community's large enough that there are certain sections that are resorting to labels as opposed to dealing with people on a personal level. It's 120,000 with the colleges and industries and so on. So no, we're not immune. And some of that labeling came out in the middle of the flood, saying, why aren't Hispanics on the sandbag lands? There was some, but the outpouring of phone calls responding to those